Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices for Change 2.0, the only podcast that focuses on mental health while mixing in movies, music, books, sports, and pop culture. Here are your hosts, Rebecca and Joe Lombardo.
It's almost Christmas. Christmas time is almost here, and we are definitely looking forward to it. We can't wait. Got our Christmas shopping pretty much just about done. We hope you guys have it well underway if you're not there yet. And just, mainly we, our producer can hear us, so that's good, that's good. This is what happens in a live radio situation, folks. We do apologize.
All kinds of fun.
We're doing our best here, so, we're waiting on our guest, who I'm not sure what's going on with him. Again, live radio and all that, you never know. So we're trying to get that situated. But in the meantime, one thing we've been doing lately to try and get in the holiday spirit is we've been watching a lot of different Christmas shows, Christmas movies and whatnot, and especially Christmas Story. That's my personal favorite. And it's been great. Beck was, she's tolerated my love of the movie over the last however many years that we've
16.
Been so. Yes. I throw that number out every week, and I don't want to drive people nuts with it. So, since we've been married and, celebrating Christmas together and everything, she basically would tolerate my all day love of watching A Christmas Story on Christmas Day. And, finally, for some reason this year, it's resonating with both of us. And I don't know if it's a nostalgia, hang on. He just called in. I don't know if it's a nostalgia thing for us watching that movie, thinking of Christmas has gone by, but it's just, I don't know, there's just something about that movie in particular that, you get the eager feeling for the season with watching it, and it's kind of, it gives you a good warm feeling. You remember how things were when we were kids and stuff, so.
Well, with that, our guest has actually called in, so we're going to introduce him now. Welcome once again to Voices for Change 2.0. We apologize for the delay. That's some of the fun that comes with a live show. But we have an exciting show in store for you today. Our guest is a very well-known and highly respected member of the mental health community. He's a best-selling author, an advocate, a public speaker, a survivor, and a dad. Well, please welcome to the show Mr. Andy Berman.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Hi,
Thank
Andy.
You, Joe. Hi.
Hey, Andy. Hi, good morning. How are you?
Oh, a little anxiety producing that I could not get through to you, but I have.
Well, we're sorry about that. We've been having some technical difficulties all morning that
it's because of the app that we the blog talk.
Oh, could be. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me.
We had issues with them before, so.
Yeah. Curse you, blog talk.
Sorry about that.
but we've got you now. So
okay, so what are we talking about today?
Well, currently we're talking about A Christmas Story.
I didn't hear that, but you can fill me in later, I guess.
No, we've been watching it a lot, and Scott actually messaged us to remind us that tomorrow night Fox is actually doing a live musical of A Christmas Story. So I'm planning on watching that. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, as for you, excuse me, I'm losing my voice again. We have a whole myriad of different questions for you. So.
Yep.
Okay.
Take a seat.
I'm ready. Am I allowed to have questions for you too, or no?
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, please do. This is less of a grilling and more of a conversation.
Oh, I like grillings though. So let's do that first.
Yeah, especially when you got hot dogs and burgers on the grill, and then they just
okay. Okay.
I'm hungry.
Keep in mind, it's 3 hours earlier in Los Angeles, so I'm not going to be as funny as you guys are.
You know what? It's never really to grill.
Okay.
Seriously, just stop doing that. It's not funny.
It's kind of funny.
No, it's.
I laughed.
He laughed. Andy,
I laughed.
He's being polite.
All right.
This is like listening to the Newlywed Game. I like this. Yup, you guys laugh.
See, it's getting around.
Okay.
All righty. So we're gonna hop right into the questions, if you don't mind.
Yep.
Go.
Down
go. Brass tack.
So, when did you first realize that you may be experiencing a mental health issue?
Oh, I've never been asked that question before, ever, never.
Seriously?
I'm kidding.
Okay.
See, I'm warming up. When did I realize I might be discussing? When did I realize I may be dealing with a mental health issue? Very, very early on. In retrospect, I was probably, 6 or 7 or 8 years old. Very
wow.
early. But, that was years ago. So there was no discussion of it. There were no therapists. I was just the kid who was a little bit more creative than other kids, and the kids who had a little bit of a different focus. But I knew there were problems very early on. I mean, oddly, and they write about this in Electro Boy, I wasn't diagnosed until I was 28 years old with bipolar disorder. But then again, that was so many years ago. I mean, I think when people read Electro Boy, which really focuses on a part of my life, that goes from about from the time I came to New York when I was 22 years old until the time I was diagnosed at 28, until I really was on my way to wellness by my late 30s. I think people think I'm still, 30-some-odd years old. I'm not. I'm older. I've got two daughters who are 10 and 12 years old. So, this quote mental health thing is very old for me. I mean, Electro Boy was published in 2002, and I don't even refer to the illness I was diagnosed with as bipolar disorder. I still call it manic depression. So That's how old it is. Okay. Yeah.
Wow. Wow, so you've been struggling with it your pretty more or less your entire life.
Yeah, well, and I don't say I'm struggling with it now. I'm living with it. Right, I know. Right. I certainly was struggling on a daily basis then, but I could even tell you today that I know that my mental health issues, my bipolar disorder, anything associated with it like anxiety, it always lurks around the corner. It doesn't go away. It's a condition. So yes, you are correct. You can say I struggle with it, but I'm living with it. I'm coping with it. I'm managing with it. But, you know, I'm speaking with it. I'm speaking about it. Sorry. And, you know, in 2002, when Electro Boy was published, nobody had any idea what I was really talking about at all. There were only a few books and specifically memoirs about people with mental health issues. And they're the old standards. They're the ones you know. Kay Redfield Jamison, William Styron. I mean, I think Electro Boy may have been one of the first books written by a male suffering with bipolar disorder. So
even now you don't hear about males as often as you do females.
Yeah, that's one thing that we've, you know, definitely come across is the awareness of men, you know, struggling with living with bipolar disorder. It's not as prevalent, you know, and it's not to say that it's not out there and it's not happening. It's just doesn't get discussed as much because, you know, men are supposed to quote unquote man up and push down their feelings and all this ridiculousness, you know, and it drives me nuts. You know, it's like, you know, it's not living, you know, it's not truly living. It's not being honest with yourself as a person when you do that, you know. That's my
absolutely
feeling.
Absolutely. Anyway. No, I mean, I think, but, you know, on the other hand, in defense of women who there's so many women who write to me after reading Electro Boy, and they say, you know, I'm suffering silently in shame, and I'm in a situation where, you know, I have children. I can't discuss my bipolar disorder. I can't discuss my bipolar disorder at work. You know, so...
Yeah, there's
we're
still
nowhere.
A lot of
like
in the
we've,
workplace.
Like everybody thinks we've come so far, and we really haven't. I mean, yes, it's discussed. Mental health and mental illness is discussed quite a bit in our own community, whether it's, you know, online in mental health self-help groups. But, you know, what kind of progress are we really making that, you know, that allows people to talk about their own mental health and their own mental illness openly and without shame? It's called slow. It's very, very slow. And that's shame.
It is. You know, it's, you know, until we're actually able to affect real change, like in policy in Washington, and have it not, you know, it gets like, just from my own personal experience, having it be talked about at work now, you know, me as a driver for, you know, I drive for a living, and, you know, I have to go and, you know, get my DOT card renewed and all these different things. And the mental health question does come up now. And, you know, there's a fear associated with that because you think to yourself, well, if I open up and talk about, you know, whatever struggle I'm going through, is my job in jeopardy? You know, do I have to worry that I'm still going to have a job tomorrow? And I think that's true for a lot of people. You know, I think that it's discussed, but not in the manner in the workplace that it needs to be discussed. You know, it's more
manner
of the company covering their butt.
It's definitely still not safe. I think the mental health movement has focused singularly on one word for 15 years, and it's called stigma. And it's never been one of my favorite words, although, you know, I'm guilty of using it all the time, or I don't use it as much as I used to because I just say it like it is. It's a combination of discrimination, fear, and shame. And I think the mental health community actually, you know, believes that if we keep banging this message of let's end stigma, then there are going to be no other issues to deal with. Well, yeah, there will be. There'll be issues of access to affordable mental health care. There'll be, there'll be issues of different techniques and methods getting well, whether it's therapy, psychiatry, alternative treatments. But we focus so much on this word, let's end the stigma. Well, yeah, when we're done with that, there's going to be 99% more work to do. So, but it's something I think that as a community, maybe 15 years ago, we grabbed onto, whether it was the DBSA or NAMI, you know, we all grabbed onto this word stigma. We all hashtag it in social media, but, how effective is that goal in erasing stigma? And to what end? Because there's so many other issues to deal with, and there's so many other ways to talk about stigma. And quite frankly, as a mental health writer and advocate, I'm kind of exhausted by the conversation. It hasn't changed too much. I mean, I always say, my goal was just to tell my story honestly in Electro Boy. It's not a pretty story because bipolar disorder is not a pretty illness. When you write about, when you write about your experience of living with bipolar disorder and, having associated addictions, drugs, alcohol, problems with spending. In my case, sexual addiction. In my case, breaking the law. I mean, I write extensively about details of my bipolar life. When I read Electro Boy, when I go back and read it, and I don't do it that much, I'm shocked that character's even me. I mean, I ended up in prison for wire fraud, for counterfeiting art. I mean, the things that I did on a daily basis, were not pretty. So it was, but I digress. What I was saying is, when I sat down to write about, I didn't sit down to write about bipolar disorder. I sat down to tell my story, which I then realized was about living with mental illness. And hey, when that book came out, everyone said, "Oh my God, it's raw and gritty, and aren't you embarrassed to write about that stuff?" And I said, "No, that's my story. It is what it is." And there were so many people who read it. I'm sorry. There were some people who read it, therapists and patients. They understood it. It was other people who had no idea what I was talking about. Like, this couldn't be possible. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing that we've kind of run into. I remember early on when Beck and I got together, a lot of people didn't understand what she was going through, and you try and explain it to them and. Some people would get it and some people, their eyes would glaze over and
but it's also easier not to understand it and not to want to understand it because, I always say, and it's the same thing all the time. so much easier to describe. I used to say, God, I just wish I was missing a limb. It would be so obvious to people. They'd see it.
Right.
I mean, mental illness is invisible. They'd see I was missing a leg and would be able to understand why I couldn't walk up the steps. You know, but when you're laying in bed and you're having an episode, or when you're generally, I wasn't having an episode laying in bed when I was running around the world, you know, flying from, you know, New York to Tokyo to Paris to wherever, you know, completely out of control. I looked okay from the outside. So there could be nothing wrong with me. I was dressed well. Yeah. I was working. I looked good. But this invisible illness thing is the killer. So.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to take a little break. We're going to be listening to If I Could by James Cobb.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
If I could, I'd make every day a beauty. Every day a wonderful hello for you. If I could, I would give you everything, anything to make you whole. If I could, I would wash away the tears of all your sorrows. If you would just allow me in your heart, and you'll know what love can be. Now the world can make you feel happy, or the world can make you feel alone. It's difficult to understand that when we're here, we're often on our own. If I could, I would find a way to tell you how important that you really are. You see, you'll always be that breath of strength. That's why people love you so. I can't believe it's true that I'm talking to you. You're making me feel this alive. Wish everyone could know you, no doubt in the mind. They'd be better if. If I could, I'd make every day a happy day. Every day so beautiful, you know, that if you would let me kindle in your heart, let me stoke the fire that feeds your soul. I can't believe it's true that as I'm could, I'd make every day a beauty, every day a wonderful hello for you. If I could, I would give you everything, anything to make you whole. If I If I could.
Hey, welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. We are so glad to have you with us. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking to a very well-known mental health advocate by the name of Andy Berman. We're really grateful to have him with us today.
Thank you.
I know we had caller calling in. I don't know if Scott's ready to bring him on the line yet or not. So until we find that out, we're going to ask a question for you.
Go for it.
Was there a history of mental illness in your family, or were you blindsided when you were finally diagnosed?
I mean, was I blindsided? Like, oh, wow, I have this thing, and where did it come from?
More like when you found out, was it like, oh, well, that explains it, you know, kind of thing, you know?
No, there wasn't. It was my issue. It was definitely my issue. But, you know, you have to understand, like, when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, it was probably 1992, okay, which is about, it's a long time ago. It's a very long
time ago.
That's
when I graduated.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was a late diagnosis, but I did not know, okay? I did not know another person who had this thing called manic depression. The only person, you know, I had read about was, you know, Kay Redfield Jamison. And when I read her book, I said, that's not exactly what I have. And then, of course, I told my doctor, I said, okay, so I've read Dr. Jamison's book, and I don't totally relate to her story. I don't get it at all. It's not my brand of bipolar disorder. And is what I have a woman's illness? Are there men with this illness? And he was able to assure me that he had seen patients. He was a very young doctor who did have bipolar disorder who were men. But still, that wasn't so encouraging, because where were they? I mean, the first mental health self group I went to in the largest city in the world, there were four people. Okay, so there was no movement. There was no movement yet. It was very strange to show up and, you know, to sit with three other people who were diagnosed with the same illness that I had been diagnosed with. It wasn't very comforting. And talking about my illness to family and friends, I mean, I was a very open person, was also very difficult, because they had no idea what the hell I was talking about. They just expected me to get better automatically. So that didn't work.
Okay.
Well, we've got a caller on the line that would like to ask a question. Scott, if you could put that caller through.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Rudy Caceres.
Yes, it is.
Hi, Rudy. How are you?
Hi, Rudy.
It's great.
Hey, buddy.
Long-time listener. Third-time caller. So,
and we love that about you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to finally be able to talk to Andy Berman. So
we're happy that
I had
we're
a question.
Able to talk to you guys.
Okay.
Yes, I had a question. So I also live in Los Angeles, like Andy, and I wanted to know, since there's a lot of ways to get in trouble in LA, especially when you have bipolar. There's a lot of vices. There's a lot of ways to spend a lot of money, be hypersexual, all that fun stuff, but also be depressed, because you see all these pretty people, you see all these rich people, you try to keep up with the Joneses. So how has that been like, especially you've lived all over the world and you've kind of settled in LA and you're pretty reclusive. Would you say that's the key to being able to live a healthy life with bipolar?
Did you say I'm pretty reclusive? How do you know that? What does that mean? No, I understand what you're saying, but I would ask the question, if I could, differently. I mean, and then we'll figure this out together. People used to say to me, you know, how do you live with bipolar disorder in New York City? And I used to say, I know, it's tough. It's the city that doesn't never sleeps. I mean, I could go out at, I could go out, at 4 a.m. I could go out to an after hours club. I could get in trouble in any possible way. Trouble was more accessible. And really, the same way it is here in Los Angeles. But the point is, okay. but the point is, I'm in a different place right now in my, and everyone would jump down my throat for me for using this word. I would jump down my throat, too, for using this word in my recovery, but in my wellness and where I am with bipolar disorder. So, what's out there, in Los Angeles, it just doesn't interest me the same way it would have maybe 15 years ago. But on the same hand, if I talk to someone in, in Southern Illinois or in, Eastern Texas, and I always say, these places are in the middle of nowhere where these people have access to nothing, they can get into more trouble than me. Living in a major city. I mean, people with bipolar disorder are the same all over the place. And generally, they can find enough ways to really sink themselves, no matter where they live. Yes, I do think it's easier when they're so much more accessible in larger cities. But, I find that bipolar disorder is bipolar disorder, wherever you live. I hope I didn't shoot down your theory because I support it, too. Yes, it is easier to find yourself in more trouble in big cities where there's more.
No, thank you.
Accessible.
And something I've learned as I've matured is that I still have bipolar, but it's kind of evolved where I'm not so easily amused and succumbing to the really dangerous stuff and irresponsible behavior, but I still get manic. I still get depressed. It's kind of just a maturation.
Right. It's like I said, it's evolving all the time, but like I always say, bipolar disorder and mania being my biggest issue, because I was probably manic 99% of the time, it always lurks around the corner. And I'd have to say that, mania, my form of mania today is anxiety. It's just a different issue to deal with.
It seems like it's constantly evolving. That's the thing I've noticed with Beck, too, is, from where we were 16 years ago to now, she recognizes situations and mood changes and all that a lot better than she did when she was in her late 20s. And
right.
I think that's probably true for everybody. You start to recognize, oh, I'm falling into this pattern. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And, hopefully you're at a point where you can catch yourself and before things get out of control.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Andy. Hopefully we can have this talk more in depth someday. And thank you, Rebecca and Joe.
Yeah, thank you, Rudy. Have a great
day.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, pal.
You too.
And Merry Christmas.
Take care. You too. Merry Christmas to all of you. Goodbye.
Thank you. We have another caller, Andy, if you're up for it. This is we're going to be talking to Kirk from Colorado.
Such a small mental health community that I know Kirk. Hi, Kirk. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you doing?
Good.
By
the way, you're supposed to have the most challenging question. Okay.
I have a couple good ones for you.
Okay.
So,
you're only allowed to have one. Okay.
Well, first of all, I did think, what you're talking about, making sure that this is more visible by reaching out to like larger communities and stuff like that is very important. One thing that you talked about that I found really fascinating, which kind of changed my whole question, was for me, I kind of wrote down, and wrote my book for the same purpose that you did, kind of to tell my story, to share things, and it enhanced my understanding. And I think a lot of people out there struggle with, you know, getting a proper diagnosis when they're dealing with a psychiatrist, because there are so many things that can seem somewhat like bipolar, borderline personality disorder, generalized anxiety, all these things, you know, coincide. So as you were talking, I thought that was probably the best and a tougher question. What would be your advice to families that are dealing with mental health issues in terms of making sure they get the proper help and the proper diagnosis? Because,
well, first of all,
you know,
I mean, I've got the question. The first issue is, and let's not. This is a question, an issue that is, you know, just agonizes me. I love that people, and Kirk, I know that you understand this, say, you know, they always say to me, well, what should the family do first? Well, you know, here's the first issue. You know, on social media, people have told me, I don't understand. You're writing about mental health. You're writing about bipolar disorder, but you're also writing about politics. Why do you think that you can write about both things? Well, I think it's pretty easy to understand now that we have this huge issue in our country. Okay, so it's about affordable health care, and that includes mental health care. And we are entirely screwed by the Trump administration, okay? So if it wasn't difficult before, it's difficult now, okay? So when people say, you know, what should families do? Well, why is there an assumption that everybody has access, not to affordable health care, but to any health care and to any kind of mental health care? I know people who wait. It kills me. They wait 3, 4, 5, 6 months because of their crappy insurance, or even with their mediocre insurance or their really great insurance, to get any kind of mental health care. And then when they get there, and, you know, I can support this. I mean, it's not like every single psychiatrist and therapist out there is fantastic. It's like, you know, the guy who comes to fix your refrigerator, sometimes he screws it up. Most of the time he screws it up. You know, I was misdiagnosed 7 times by great doctors. I was diagnosed with depression. Yeah, that's in part because bipolar disorder is difficult to diagnose. And it's more difficult to diagnose than schizophrenia. But, I mean, you know, the point is, you know, people who are diagnosed with depression, they sometimes don't even have depression. There's so many other issues that it could be. So, you know,
so
everyone's just thinking.
Question.
Well, hold on. Before you, I just want to finish my point. You know, there's just this assumption that, oh, if you feel like you have a mental health issue, then just go to a psychiatrist or a therapist. Well, first you have to get over the first hurdle, which isn't the shame. Well, it may be the shame of going to see somebody if that's your issue. But the other is, who's out there to help you? Who's really waiting to help you? How are you going to get in for an appointment? I mean, I know people who tell me that, yeah, I see my psychiatrist. My insurance allows me to see my psychiatrist 4 times a year. I'm like, well, do you see a therapist? And they say, no, that's not paid for.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd say 90% of people are just absolutely just cut out of access to mental health care.
Yeah, my sister right now, just because of the loss of my brother-in-law, is struggling to find a therapist for the little girls because they're under Medicaid. So she has to go through just a million hurdles to even get a chance to possibly see a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so that kind of leads me to my other question, which is, how do you think people like yourself that are a proven mental health advocate, not because you write about it, but because you manage it, you live it, and you show other people how to do that. So how can we, as that particular type of community, work with the professionals to help kind of maybe circumvent the problems we are getting from this current administration?
Well, I mean, I've got 11 answers to your second question. And one is, first of all, that that it's a hell of a job. There are self-help groups, which can be very helpful to people who don't have any kind of access. I always say sharing our stories, like I did in Electro Boy, extremely honestly, to the point where, you know, people I knew and family said, ugh, I can't even read that. It's so embarrassing. It's important to do. And, you know, but you know, the other issue is that, and it's a criticism of the mental health community, and I'm shocked that nobody ever makes it. The mental health community in the last 15 years or so has become so splintered. There was one day when there was just a group called NAMI and there was a group called DBSA.
Yeah.
And then, you know, perhaps because of social media, mental health advocates, advocacy groups, there's thousands and thousands of thousands. And they all have their own agendas, although they all have so much in common. But they fight each other. They fight each other for I don't know what the term is exactly, but for they're always jockeying in position for, you know, listen to us, listen to us, listen to us, don't listen to them, don't listen to them. But, you know, there's thousands of groups, which is, you know, very confusing to people. There's a lot of infighting, and it's I mean, there's so much that we all have in common, that, you know, this has to stop. And a lot of people are, you know, are doing this from behind a computer. You know, they're doing it on Facebook. They're doing it on Twitter. I mean, 15 years ago, there was no social media. So if you were going to fight the fight, you'd have to get out there and talk to groups. You'd have to face them. But go back to your question, because, you know, that's just a pet peeve of mine. That
no, it's a really good point. I love the fact that you bring that up, because why would we not, you know, gather together, especially on a common goal, which is to get the proper health and care that everyone deserves? And that is actually something that I have not heard.
Well, because we're totally disorganized, and the largest mental health groups are entirely, when I answer, okay, let's not say entirely, are 80% financed by the worst people, and that's the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry does not have the same agenda as patients. The pharmaceutical industry has one agenda, and that's to keep people on medication, to keep them away from therapy, to keep them away from alternative treatments, because they don't make a penny. They don't make a penny. So when your DBSA group wants to have a conference and they want to meet, well, you just turn to the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, they throw you a few thousand dollars. You know, I mean, and I have to tell you, even if one pharmaceutical company pays a national mental health group $50,000 a day, they made that in the last 1 minute. It's nothing for them. But the point is, we have to be able to say, screw you guys, we don't want your dirty money, and you're not going to come in and hand out your pencils and hand out your, you know, your T-shirts, and, you know, use us as, really, to use us as a group to keep us on your medications.
Well, so you certainly know how
help,
I feel about
it. They don't help advocacy, and they don't help advocacy at all. I mean, they're one of the biggest problems, the pharmaceutical industry. And I know well, because I was sucked in by them, and I played their game too. And it was a huge mistake. It was a huge mistake.
Well, you know what, you and I have already talked about how hard it's been for me to even get any of this stuff researched because of the same problem. If there's not profit in a new venture, they're not going to lay down their money. And especially if there's risk involved. And so even with scientific studies, like I said, I have one patent and then I filed a new provisional one. And even with solid scientific evidence, we are still kind of stuck trying to fight through red tape, and we can't get anything researched, and we have some really solid and fascinating answers. So I do think, you know, that was a beautiful answer. So I'm going to just leave it at that and let you guys get back to the show. I love listening. So you are all just amazing. So big hugs to all of you, and certainly I'll be
in
touch.
Thank you, Kirk.
Thanks, Kirk. Thanks for calling in, buddy. It was good talking to you.
And you know, the other thing is that, you know, we're not supposed to be angry. We're supposed to be quiet, and we're supposed to just sit around and talk
grateful.
About we're supposed to sit around and talk about what we're allowed to talk about, which is stigma. We're not allowed to talk about, you know, people criticize me. Oh, you know, what are you talking about? Like I said before, what are you talking about politics? What are you talking about? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. You're a mental health advocate. Well, everyone's got it all wrong. Absolutely wrong. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Sit around and just, you know, talk about the things that we're allowed to talk about? I'm done talking about stigma. And when I say that, I don't mean that it's not a huge issue. There are so many people in the mainstream who don't understand, you know, they don't understand that there is this thing called mental illness. So I think we just got too caught up in the word stigma, and we forgot the word shame, and we forgot the word discrimination. I mean, was I discriminated against because I was this guy who was taking, you know, 14 medications a day and going into the hospital every 2 weeks and having electroshock therapy, which is why my book is called Electro Boy? Yeah, absolutely. People didn't want to come near me. I mean, let alone talk about hiring me. They didn't want to see me.
Right.
I mean, they didn't want to come over. They didn't want to help. If I had had diabetes, it would have been no problem. If I had cancer, it would have been wonderful. You know, they would have been able to deal with it. But, like, again, and I'm repeating myself, this invisible illness just doesn't work.
It's insidious, you know, where, you know, you want help and you want to try and get out there, and the people that don't understand, they don't want to take the time to understand it. So finding a compassionate ear is, you know, it's an undertaking. It's difficult, you know. And
right. And
I completely
right. And
agree
once
with
you find that compassionate ear, then you have to have access to affordable and quality mental health care, which don't go hand in hand.
Exactly.
They just don't. They don't.
Yeah.
When a psychiatrist is charging, you know, for a consultation, you know, for 2.5 hours, you know, a first consultation, $1,300, and doesn't accept insurance, and that's your best referral, you're in trouble. Most people are in trouble.
Yeah.
90% of people are in trouble. When you need to go to a rehab and your choices are a $15,000 a month rehab, you know, all the way up to, you know, an $80,000 a month rehab, and your insurance is paying, you know, 15%, most families are in trouble. So
that's the issue that people don't recognize or want to realize or want to accept, is the problem with the healthcare industry in this country is it's based on profit. And it's unconscionable that it's a profit-based thing when we're talking about people's lives and their health. And, you know, it kills me that it gets monetized. You know, when you look at, you know, any other industrialized country that has, you know, nationalized healthcare or whatever, you know, yeah, they have their own hoops that they have to jump through too, but they're also not going into bankruptcy to pay for their medicine.
Right. No,
you know?
No, I mean,
I think
everybody can tell the story of showing up at their pharmacy. I mean, I can tell you, you know, and paying for a, and being told that, you know, for a 30-day supply of X, in my case, Abilify, which is made by Bristol Myers Squibb, I needed to give them my credit card which, you know, I guess they assumed had $1,400 available on it. Well, it didn't. But, you know, everybody's been through that. Healthcare in this country is, well, not just for mental health care, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But did you want me to answer any other questions? Because we haven't answered questions yet. But
well, actually, right about now, we do have to take another quick break. We still have a lot to talk about, so we're going to, our show's going to run over a little bit today because,
okay.
Andy is such an interesting guest.
Yep.
But, we're, like I said, going to take a quick break, and this is Casey Lansdale, Living in the Moment.
Easy to get off track. Easy to lose your way in a world that makes you believe there's no time to waste, that you gotta have it all, better have it all, better not slow down. Looking ahead got me looking in circles.
Welcome back to Voices for Change 2.0. I'm Joe. This is Rebecca sitting next to me. And in case you missed it earlier, we are having an awesome conversation today with Mr. Andy Berman, Electro Boy himself. And thanks again for being on our humble little show, Mr. Berman. We are happy to have you.
Well, it's not a little show. I mean, it's a lot of people know about it, and B, everything that you're doing, you know, whether it's, you know, you're getting out the message. Everybody's getting out the message. Whether it's the hashtag, mm-hmm. keep talking MH, you know, it's getting out the message. So it's not a little show.
Oh,
everything that everybody little. I mean, I'm a little guy too. I wrote a little book called Electro Boy. It just happened to sell, you know, a bunch of copies. I mean, it's not even available. Well, you can find used copies on Amazon. I hate. I just love the fact. Not that I make money on those copies anymore. I mean, Random House doesn't even own my book, because Electro Boy will be turned into a feature film finally, and then it'll be published again. Yeah, thank God.
That's awesome.
It's only been 19 years in the making, but so yeah, shoot with your questions.
You got it.
Well, that was one of them.
Okay.
So you handled that one quite easily. Do you feel perhaps like, I mean, I know that you're not married anymore, and I'm curious, as, and feel free to tell me to stuff it if you want to.
No, I will never tell you to stop, Rebecca. Never, never, never. Keep going.
I'm curious as to whether or not you think maybe your mental illness had a hand in the demise of your marriage.
No, it was not my mental illness that had a demise in the hand of my in my marriage. No, not at all. I mean, and I'll write about it in the sequel to Electro Boy quite a bit. I married somebody whose mother had bipolar disorder and took her life. Maybe not the best way to come together with somebody. I mean, she was interested in my story. She actually was a film producer who optioned it to turn it into a film. She didn't do it successfully. And I think I very much wanted to explain her mother's illness to her. But I think by the time we were married, I think that my mental health was extremely solid. So no, it didn't play a role in my divorce at all. Okay. No. I mean, I'll take it one step further if you'd like. I don't care. It was probably her mental health issues which played the much larger role in why our marriage didn't stay together. But.
Okay. Yeah, because we run into that. You know, and this is one of the reasons we do the show, is people ask us, well, how do you guys do it? How do you stay together? You know, blah, 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 and all this. And it's, you know, it's a constant work every day, you know, but there are, for those of us that are able to do it, there's, you know, others that, you know, sometimes people are just incompatible, you know, and there's myriad reasons why. And sometimes, you know, especially those of us with mental health issues, that can be a factor. And, you know, sometimes it just isn't there, you know,
Got it.
Doesn't matter how hard you work at it. You know, you try and try and try, but you know,
got it.
You do what you have to. So, what are some coping mechanisms that you use if you're having a bad day?
The nap. No, I'm kidding. No, but you know, when people ask me,
great.
Yeah. Sometimes I just say, you know, I'm just going to stop doing what I'm doing. I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing today. I'm going to take a break. I mean, you know, after a while, I mean, I'm exhausted, absolutely exhausted by the same crap that's out there and written about every single day about mental health. I mean, you know, it's time for new voices. It's time for professionals who really understand patients, who care about their patients. So, you know, it's my time to plug a friend, and, you know, and hopefully you'll have her as a guest on your show one day. But it's Dr. Hillary Jacobs-Hendel.
She's scheduled.
Yeah, and she's written a book called It's Not Always About Depression, which is been published by Random House. But I mean, this is just an out of the box thinker who's not throwing out the same crap. So I'd be curious to listen to the show with her. So, you know, we need more mental health care professionals who are not in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, almost every psychiatrist I have has been in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, they all need to be called out. You know, one of the worst of them, you know, is a guy named Dr. Mark Frey, who used to be at UCLA. Now he's at the Mayo Clinic running the bipolar clinic. I mean, this is a guy who made gazillions of dollars as a medical expert, you know, to, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 pharmaceutical companies a year. How many patients did he have? I don't know, 2, 3. But, you know, these are the people that we're supposed to listen to. They're the experts. So it's time to listen to, you know, people who are talking about different issues and talking about different kind of treatments and talking about different ways of dealing with mental health and mental health, you know, just getting away from the same crap of, okay, thanks for talking to me for an hour, here's your prescription. You know, we forget how valuable talk therapy is because, you know, we're convinced because all we see on TV day after day after day are, you know, ask your doctor about this medication. Really? So now patients are going to go to their doctors and say, oh, I saw a commercial. I'd like to try this medication. Well, you know, there are other things besides medication, and that would include therapy or alternative treatments.
And it's funny. It's funny that you mentioned that. I got to interject, Andy, because this is funny that you're saying, you know, approach your doctor about, you know, talking about this medication. We did that once. There was an ad for some medication, and Beck was curious about it, and we went and asked our doctor about it, and it was the strangest conversation because he just blew the whole thing off, and
he was just like, "Yeah, that'd be great if that worked."
Yeah,
right.
It's like, yeah. So I was just, it's bizarre. It's like when you listen to the list of side effects from these different new medications, it's like, why am I going to ask a doctor about that when it's going to make my ass fall off?
Right.
You know what I mean? So. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Just I had to.
No.
So, tell me, do you ever have concerns about your children with bipolar disorder?
Yeah, that's a question. I mean, usually that's a question. Usually, I'm asked more aggressively. I remember being in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I was speaking about Electro Boy, and someone said, "How could you even think about having children? That's so selfish." Well, because my kids, you know, first of all, I'm extremely vigilant. I watch my kids, you know, like a proverbial hawk. And they're not so much more likely to have a mood disorder. Not so much more. Yes, a little bit more. So, yes, in answer to your question, yes, I am always concerned about it. But I think some of the best parents are parents who, in our case, have bipolar disorder and are super vigilant about their own mental health and, in turn, are ridiculously vigilant about their kids and watching their kids. And, you know, the myth that parents with mental health issues can't be good parents or role models is bullshit. You're allowed to say that on the show? Okay.
I did.
So, I mean, the point is, I think we're better parents. I think we can be better parents. I think we're watching out for the right things. So that's my answer to your question, Rebecca.
That was a good answer.
That was a good answer. Thank you. Well, I think we're gonna make this our last question and let you get on with your day and everything. What is next on the horizon for you, and where can people reach you?
Where can people reach me? They can call me at home. No, I'm kidding. I'll give you the quick background. The book I wrote 15 years ago, which when I read it today, I don't read it too much, like I told you. I mean, it's just as current as it was when it was published in 2002, is Electro Boy. There are not that many copies left. There are basically used copies, some traded new copies. You can access that directly on Amazon. You can go to my website, which is electroboy.com. I'm on Twitter at electroboyusa. That's basically how you can reach me. What's on the horizon? I'm writing a sequel to Electro Boy, which is about, you know, it's still about mental health, but it's about different different parts of it. It's not my raw and gritty memoir. It's what happened next, which is that bipolar guy marries a woman with bipolar mother who took her life, has two kids, realizes that there are a lot of other issues in the marriage which lead to a divorce. So it's about mental health. It's about marriage. It's about divorce. It's about all the stressors, which for a person with bipolar disorder, you know, would seem almost impossible to go on with, but I did. And it's funny because you guys said in this interview or in some posting, you referred to me as a survivor. Nobody ever referred to me as a survivor. And I was actually touched by that because, you know, damn it, I am a survivor. I mean, there's just, it's almost impossible.
Absolutely.
It's almost impossible that I made it through, you know, stage one of this illness, which was, you know, just struggling to find medication to keep me balanced and, you know, three suicide attempts and, you know, making it through that. But I just never thought of myself as a survivor just because I kept going and going and going. So the next is a sequel to the book. Yeah, I'd love, I'm waiting, you know, I've been waiting patiently for somebody to finally turn Electro Boy into a film. But I believe that we're, you know, 90% there before we'll go into pre-production, and that'll be exciting. And that's really what's on the horizon. And, you know, taking care of two kids as a single dad. That's what I'll be doing.
That's definitely an undertaking. That's definitely an undertaking.
Yeah, but, I'm lucky. Two easy kids, but yeah. And then, you know, and then the other issue is, you know, changing the conversation. And I'm just repeating myself a little bit, but changing the conversation about mental health and, you know, kind of getting a little bit unstuck from the word stigma. Because, yeah, once stigma is erased, well, then there's so many other issues to deal with. And letting mental health be a political issue because of access to affordable health care and you know, really going a step further and choosing people to represent us in Congress who care about mental health, who understand it,
right,
who know it from family and friends, who aren't going to screw us. So I think that's important.
It absolutely is important. You and I could have a conversation about that all day.
Okay.
Because we're of the same mindset for sure on that. Well, you know, it sounds like you have some great stuff lined up, and I can't wait for the sequel to Electro Boy to come out. And we would absolutely love to have you back on to talk about it when it does.
Okay.
And you know, same thing with the movie. You know, once you get that, you know, up and running.
Yeah, just give us a shout.
Absolutely, and you know, anything we can do to get the word out on stuff, you know, just let us know. And
thank you guys, really, thank you guys for doing what you do. I mean, you know, you said you're the little guys. You're not the little guys. Everybody who's out there, you know, doing this, whether they're, you know, 5,000 people listening or 10,000 or 100,000 or a million, is having an impact. I mean, it's just that we want to hit a different demographic. We want to hit people who don't know the first thing about mental health being a real problem in this country, or who don't believe it, or who don't buy into it. We want them to know what we're doing. Okay.
Absolutely.
I am thankful for your having me on your show.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time out of your day I know you've got a lot going on. So
yeah,
thank you once again for being on with us. And like we said, you know, if anything else comes up, just give us a shout and we'll squeeze you in somewhere.
Okay, I'll probably call you in about 2 hours. Okay.
Sweet.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
okay.
Andy, and have a great holiday season.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you, bud.
Bye.
And we are going to end the show with Dare to Dream by Musical Faustus.
It's from the Musical Faustus.
From the Musical. See you later, everybody.
There was a world I longed to find, but living was labored and life was unkind. Yet I was determined to press through the fog and the steam. So I dared to dream.
The future is not up to me or to you.
You can't believe all the lies you've been told. You can't control your own fate. Listen to what I am saying before it's too late. Where is the boy inside the man? What are his wishes and what is his plan? You'd be a hero held in the highest.
I've lived under orders and stayed out of sight. Then suddenly you've come and opened my eyes. And now I can see past the fables and lies. I've longed to be looked at instead of looked through. The future is focused on you. Show me a world where I can be me. We can be everything we want to be. With this new promise, we'll be forever supreme. Dream. We'll be remembered as history's promising team. Let's dare to
Don't miss the Mental Health Memoir of the Year, It's Not Your Journey. It's Not Your Journey is the true story of one woman's 20-year battle with mental illness and her recovery from a suicide attempt in 2013. Rebecca Lombardo candidly reveals her real and raw emotions in dealing with depression, bipolar disorder, the loss of her mother and brother, and more. Pick it up today on Amazon.com or visit www.RebeccaLombardo.com for more information.
Join us next week as Rebecca and Joe continue to battle the stigma of mental illness. Follow us on Twitter at Voices for Change RJ and on Facebook at Voices for Change 2.0.